off another guy, a club at the club and started working with my dad.
Okay, what was he doing?
He was a roofer.
Right.
What do you do from here? If you don't get a club, what do you do?
Came out to Lambert. He's lifted it in here for Karl-Heinz Riedler! What a sumptuous cross from the Scotsman.
Delivio had a ink mark on his wrist.
3-1.
That was it. I said to Pablo, have you seen that? He said, he does it every time before a big game. And I thought, all right, okay, let's see how this pans out.
He was right.
I know.
Oh, Ricken's in here. It's Lars Ricken. Oh, that's extraordinary. Dreams do come true.
When you actually lift that trophy, you think, wow, this is incredible. I'm from Glasgow. You've done all right coming from where you've came from.
All right, let's set the wobbly screen machines to 1996. What a year. Spice Girls in the charts. Charles and Diana getting divorced, Independence Day in the cinema, Euro 96 on the telly, Champions League, we were up to season 5, the last one with only champions in it. In Scotland, football was booming, Walter Smith had revolutionised Rangers, Craig Brown had almost qualified Scotland to the knockout stages of Euro 96. Meanwhile, a young Scottish midfielder named Paul Lambert was facing life among the unemployed, running out his contract at Motherwell. Within 9 months, he would be marking Zinedine Zidane in the Champions League final, setting up a key goal and being man of the match as Dortmund beat Juve in Munich. And he joins us today. Paul, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure, James.
The summer of 1996, what was that summer like for you?
It was pretty strange, really. I knew my contract was running out at Motherwell. I knew exactly what was going on. And Big Alec McLeish was a manager at Motherwell at that time. He tried to get me to re-sign, but it just wasn't really for me at that moment. It wasn't what I was looking for. And then a teammate of mine actually left to go to 20 Enschede, a guy called Rob McKinnon. And Rob McKinnon, I think he was probably maybe the first Bosman at that point. Rob phoned me during the summer. I said, what are you going to do? Are you going to re-sign with Motherwell? I said, Rob, no. I said, but the problem I've got is there's nowhere for me to go. I don't know what to do. He said, listen, an agent who got me this move, I'll get him to give you a call. And at that time, I never had an agent, James, you know. He said, this guy will call you. And sure enough, the agent's name was Ton Van Dalen. And God rest him, now he's dead. He called me up. He said, Paul, I heard you want to play abroad. I went, yeah, that'd be really nice. I'd never met this guy. This is the first conversation. He said, if you give me 10 days, I'll call you. I said, the only problem is, Ton, Motherwell are going to pre-season to Northampton down in England. I said, and they're expecting me to go. He says, right, well, the decision's yours. You either go or you stay and you take the chance. And I come off the phone. I said, right, okay, I'll throw a sickie into Motherwell. I'll stay at home. As long as you promise you phone me. He went, listen, I'll phone you in 10 days' time. On the 10th day, 100% he phoned me. He says, pack your bags and meet me in Enschede. I fly from Glasgow to Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. I get a small flight to Enschede. Never known this guy, so I don't know what I'm looking for when I land in Enschede. But this time, I don't know what teams I'm going to. I get there. He says, right, Paul, nice to meet you. Ton Van Dalen. He said, nice to meet you. He said, I've got two teams for you. He said, the first team I'm going to drive you to, and you've got 5 days of training. He says, it's PSV Eindhoven. I went, oh, okay. And he said, the second one, if this doesn't work, you're going to Borussia Dortmund. I expected him to turn around and say to me that I was going to go to Azerbaijan or somewhere, you know?
Right.
And that's exactly how it
would happened. Would you have gone to Azerbaijan, Paul?
Absolutely, no chance whatsoever. Do you know what? If I never got a club, I'd have probably started to work with my dad.
Okay, what was he doing?
He was a roofer.
Okay.
He was a roofer, and I was 25 at the time.
Right.
Said, well, what do you do from here? If you don't get a club, what do you do?
Okay. As it turned out, though, well, you knew Borussia Dortmund because you played against them with Motherwell a couple of seasons before, and there's this great story about you and Billy Davis standing in front of what I mean nowadays we term the yellow wall, I guess, and saying, "Can you imagine playing here every week?"
That was it. And that was a warm down, and Billy and I we went out to do a warm down. Big Alec sent us out. Motherwell played a great game that day. We only lost 1-0, but we played a really good game against these guys who are an incredible team. I remember running around the warm down. I said, at that time, German football still is the same. You tend to find the crowds never leave the stadium, even after the game. All the fans start to hang around and they have a beer, whatever they want to do. And Billy and I were running around. I said, Billy, can you imagine playing in front of this every other week? He went, this is incredible. This And that was the end of the conversation. There was never any, I'd love to play here. It was, and then I think 2 or 3 years later, I ended up playing here.
Mm. So you'd rung in, or you'd not told Motherwell what you were doing. The deal you were on there, I think on the contract that you basically were seeing out was what, £500 a week, £500 a week, which when you think about that, you know, now in terms of being a professional footballer is pretty extraordinary. But it does seem incredibly random. You're running down a contract, you haven't had any offers, a guy you've never met on the recommendation of a friend rings you up, you fly out to Amsterdam with no idea of where you might be going.
No.
And plan B was to become a roofer.
There was no backup. That was a backup because where would I have went? I couldn't have went back to Motherwell.
You couldn't?
No, because you'd made up your mind and I'd made up my mind I was leaving Motherwell. Where was I going to go? If I had no club, I had to find a job, you know?
Is football still like that, do you think? Do players make decisions like that in quite the same carefree way these days, do you think?
I don't think you would get anybody doing that now, James. I don't think you would get anybody. Basically, I always talk about this and always say, see if I had a 10 pence in my pocket and flicked it and said, tails, I win and heads, you lose. Thankfully, fell on the tails because it was massive. It was a massive, massive gamble we had. We took an unbelievable gamble that this would pay off. But when I went there, I didn't go there exactly to sign. I went there on trial.
Mm.
I'd actually 4 games to play on trial.
Well, before that, you had PSV with, what, Dick Advocaat, no?
Yeah.
How was that?
I went there and we trained. I trained for, all in, I was there for about 5 days. I played 2 games. Mr. Advocaat played me wide right. But I was never a winger. I never had the speed to have 1v1 situations. But when I looked at PSV Eindhoven, they had a really good side at that year as well. I think Arthur Newman was there. Luke Nealis was there. Wim Jonk was there. Philip Koku was there. They had a really, really top side. But I played outside right and actually scored 2 goals in 2 games. That was just wasn't like me. I went back to the hotel on the 15. Mr. Advocaat came up and said, Paul, I know you're going to Borussia Dortmund on trial, but I need a winger. He said, I think you're maybe a centre midfielder. I went, that's where I am. That's where I've been playing. He went, listen, good luck to you. Me and Ton van Dalen jumped in the car and then we drove up to Dortmund.
Okay, so this is you and this gentleman who you'd met only days before. How long a drive would that be?
So it took us, I'll never forget that drive. It took us about 2.5 hours.
Right. What did you talk about?
Do you know the credible thing was? The real credible thing was he smoked unbelievable. He must have been smoking 10 every 3 minutes. It was incredible. I had to open the window, was fumigated with the cigarette smoke. I was like, oh, this is incredible. I don't know what I'm going to say to this guy. But I'll tell you what, how big he was when it really sunk in. Uh-huh. A lot of the managers for England phoned him when he was on the phone. So he was a big hitter, this guy. And I never realised he was a big hitter, but a lot of people phoned him and he said, Paul, sorry, I need to take this call. He said, listen, when we get to Dortmund, we'll meet the general manager who was a guy called Michael Meyer, Mr. Meyer, as I still call him. He said, we'll meet him and then let's see where it goes. We continued that journey and met Mr. Meyer in the offices of Dortmund.
So how were you feeling through this? I'm guessing a little bit nervous about the fact that this was now the second of your 2 chances. And also because it would kind of be your dream move based on your experience there a couple of years before and the size of the club.
Nervous. I think nervous is an understatement. I was absolutely bricking it. I really was. It was an incredible feeling because I'm thinking this is going to be incredible. But when I went to the offices, Mr. Meyer and Ton van Dalen only spoke in German. After half an hour, Mr. Meyer went out the room and Ton says, Paul, you've got 4 trial games. And if you sign, the deal's done. There's your contract. There's how much money you get a week. There's the bonus system. There's the appearance money. And I looked at it and I went, this is incredible. I said, this is way, way above my head. But I was on at Motherwell. He went, so that's the deal. But if you sign, that's it. But you've got 4 trial games to play. So Mr. Meyer came back in and he says, Paul, he said, do you understand that? I went, yeah. I said, there's only one problem. I said, I was meant to be back in Scotland and I don't have any money here. I have no money left. He went, okay. He said, I'm going to give you 200 Deutschmarks at the time. If you sign, you give me it back. If you don't sign, you keep it. And then he went, you're going to go to Lübeck, he said, which is a good journey away in a car. He says, Ton will leave you and you'll get a driver to Lübeck where the team will meet you.
Hmm.
And I went, right, okay. I went outside and this Mercedes pulled up outside the Dortmund offices. And this guy got out I don't know German. He don't know a word of English. I get in the car, and as all British people do when you can't understand another language, you talk with your hands. I was pointing to my watch and things like that, as if to say, how long drive? He went to me, four. And I went, four? He went, 4 hours. He says, but don't worry, I do it in two. Mm. And this guy, swear to his word, he absolutely nailed the autobahn.
Because there's no speed limit, is there?
No, absolutely. There was no speed limit. I had a white knuckle ride. I know him really well now, this guy, because obviously I was there. So, and I met him the other week there and made a laugh about that. It was incredible.
When you had a laugh about it the other week, Paul, were you speaking to him in German?
Yeah, no, we speak now in German and we have a laugh. He goes to English and I go to German. So we can It was really good, really good.
Back in 1996, though, you just arrived off this kind of white-knuckle ride and you, what, go straight in to meet your teammates? Are you playing what the first of these? This was in a pre-season tournament.
Yeah.
Do you play that day or just meet with the players?
The team are flying in, but when we arrived at the airport in Lubeck, James, I just saw a mass of yellow and black and I thought, what is this here? And then I realised there was thousands of fans watching the team come in a plane. But Walter Mass, who was a driver, drove me on the tarmac. He says, Paul, when the plane lands, let introduce you to Otmar Hitzfeld and Michael Henke. And I says, okay. The bus comes on the tarmac. The team gets on the bus. I go and meet Otmar and Michael Henke. And he says, Paul, good luck. Hope it goes really well for you. Just go and find a seat on the bus. I must have sat on about 5 or 6 seats. And every time I sat next to a player, they said, you can't sit there. You can't sit there. You can't sit there. You can't. I mean, well, why are they not letting me sit beside them? I don't know these guys. Maybe they don't like me. And then Stefan Kloss says, there's a free seat beside me. I was up and sat beside Stefan and he said, hello, good luck. Hope it goes well for you. And we went to the tournament that afternoon. And in German football, they play a mini tournament before the season starts. And we played 45 minutes against Lübeck and 45 minutes against Hamburg. But Otmar played me in the centre of the field and had a good game against Lübeck and had a good game against Hamburg. And I thought, well, nobody's really talking to me here because of the language barrier, but I don't know how well I'm doing. Maybe I'm doing well in my own eyes, but not doing well in their eyes. But the corner of my eye, I saw Stefan Reuter, and he looked to Otmar, and he put his thumbs up as if to say, yeah, he's. And I thought, I must be doing something okay here. And that's where it started to trigger. I think, I must be doing all right. But they gave me another 2 games. But the next 2 games was against Schalke, which is an incredible derby game. And that was going to be it was a Fuji Cup at the time, Bayern, Dortmund, Schalke, Mönchengladbach, 4 teams in this little mini tournament. Semi-final was us, Schalke, and Bayern and Gladbach. Schalke beat us 3-1, and the crowd that night was 30,000 in this small ground, and I went, this is massive, this is, and this is the first time I got a real glimpse of Andy Müller, how quick he was.
Right.
Where I thought, well, this guy is another level to what I'm used to. But a lot of the team weren't there because they had Euro 96 taken back from. But some of them were there and some weren't. But they'd signed Paulo Sousa from Juve, who you probably know pretty well, that same season.
Right.
At that point. So Paulo wasn't there. Played the 2 games. And then Thursday before the Bundesliga started, Otmar came up to me and says, Paul, we'd like you to stay. He said, we know the contract's done. We'd like you to stay. And that was on the Thursday before the Saturday, before the season started.
It's crazy, isn't it? And you had Billy Davis ringing you up through this period saying, where are you?
Yeah.
The boss is going mad. Why haven't you turned up for training yet?
That was it. He said, where are you? I said, well, you're not going to believe it. I'm going to tell you. And he went, where are you? I went, Borussia Dortmund. And he went, no, you're kidding. No. And I went, honestly, I'm here. I said, you'll not believe it. And then he said, he's gone mad. He doesn't have a clue where you are. I said, don't say nothing where I am because it's not done yet. I said, I've got to play these trial games and then see how it goes. And that's exactly how it worked.
You mentioned some of the players in that Dortmund team. Paulo Sousa is arriving from Juve. Andres Müller. Matthias Sammer's in there.
Yeah.
The manager, a legend in German football, Otmar Hitzfeld. You're clearly a self-confident person. You wouldn't have taken this chance if you weren't, I guess. But were there moments in there, particularly before they finalised the deal, when you thought, I've made a really big mistake here?
Do you know what? I wasn't self-confident until I actually played there. I went in there with real trepidation and thinking, if this doesn't work, I'm really struggling. I was kind of shy kind of person. I never had a great belief in my ability until they really got it out of me. And I went in there with a little bit of trepidation. I thought, well, I looked at the squad, Jürgen Kohler, Julio Cesar, Paulo Sousa, Andy Müller, Stefan Reuter, Schapi Saar, Karl-Heinz Riedler, Andy Müller, Jörg Heine, they were all there. And I thought, how did I get a game? How did I actually get a game here? But I made it in my mind, I was thinking, well, do you know what? See, if I don't get a game, I'm going to learn.
Right.
I started to write everything down, what I'd done and what I ate and how we trained and what we trained and what times we trained. I'd written a dossier of what they'd done. And I thought, it's the first time in my real career that I'm going to really learn big-time football. On the Friday before the Leverkusen game, Otmar came to me and says, Paul, if Paolo's knee's okay, he'll play and you'll be on the bench. Paolo's knee never made it.
Mm.
And he came to me on the Friday night and he says, I'm going to play you. He said, there's a guy you need to watch, a guy called Paolo Sergio, who was this Brazilian. And I played my first game and I never knew German. So I never knew right, left, man on, time, head. I never knew any language. I was just thrown in. And Paolo Sergio took the ball off me. I think he took the ball off me twice. And he scored one. I thought, well, this is way above my level that I'm used to be playing. I get to half-time. I scored just before half-time. It gives me a little bit of self-confidence. And I get to half-time. I says to Andy, I said, Andy, you're going to tell me the language for right, left, man on, time. And he told me in German. I thought, if I can master the football language really quickly, it might start to fall into place. And that's what happened.
How many words do you need as a footballer to be able to function in a foreign league? Like when a player comes over, the interviews, etc., that's all kind of by the by. But to actually function as part of a team, how much do you need to know of a language?
I think you had to know the football language, James. See, the football language for me was vital for me at that time. So that time, it's not like now where, for example, I went to Borussia Dortmund a couple of weeks back there and Marco Rosa was fantastic. The coach, he speaks English to a lot of the guys. Obviously, Jude Bellingham's there, English, and you've got different nationalities now where they can all speak English. So it's, when you hear the coach going from German to English or there's translators there, in my time it was either, a lot of the lads had played the Juve, so you had the solo. When you heard solo, you knew you were on your own, or German for time was Zeit. So I knew they was right was rechts, links was left. So I knew Hinterman was man on, and I thought, if I can just master these little words here, I'll be all right if I can get a game.
Right.
And it wasn't until the second game that it started to come.
Socially, though, so your first meeting, you'd have the kind of gauntlet of coach seats until you finally found a home.
Yeah.
Were the team quite welcoming after that? Were they used to having people pitching up from abroad?
I don't think so. Not somebody come from Motherwell. They'd have thought I was probably then to make up the reserve team or something like that. Because you've got to remember, the Germans had won Euro 96.
Well, they were on back-to-back Bundesliga titles as well.
Yeah, and when I looked at the squad, I went, dear, oh dear, this is a proper team, this could be really, really good here. In Euro 96, Stefan Freund had hurt his knee. I think Stefan had done his cruciate ligament, and they needed a centre midfielder. Whether I was going to be that guy or somebody else was going to be that guy, then I guess they were the judges of that. But when I did sign, to be fair to them, every one of them came up and shook my hand and said, good luck, hope it goes well. And then it started to go from there.
I read that you bonded in particular with Andreas Müller because he'd just beaten England.
Me and him had done. We used to fight like cat and dog on the pitch, you know. Sometimes he might know why to run back the way, and I would lay into him, but he was probably the best player that I'd ever played with because of the speed and how good he was. And we used to play head tennis every morning before training, and it became unbelievable competitive, me and Andy, in the morning. It was incredible, but we still keep in contact, which was great. But yeah, he was probably the best player that I'd ever played with.
He used to sing "Football's Coming Home" on the training field.
Well, ask him about the penalty when he scored.
Right. He scored the winning penalty against England.
Yeah, and his celebration was that hands in the hips thing. And everybody before would say, oh, Andy Müller's arrogant, Andy Müller's this. You couldn't have met a nicer guy. But as a professional footballer and a top player, I mean, dear, oh dear, he was absolutely fantastic.
So, what was it like then to play in front of the yellow wall?
Well, my first home game was against Fortuna Düsseldorf. This is where the pennies really dropped for me. This game was the one that I thought, I'm one of these players now. Was we played Düsseldorf and had one of the games where everything went right. I set up two goals. The fans loved us. And I looked at the bench and Otmar was making two substitutions at that night. On was coming Paolo Sosa was coming on, and Carl Riedler was coming on. And automatically thought, well, it must be me. I'm only from Motherwell. It must be me who's going to change. And it wasn't my number. I thought to myself, that's it. See, you stay in this team. I ain't coming out. And I'm going to start to really be one of these. And then from that game on, I was in the team. I earned my place and probably in their respect and the way I played.
Hmm.
I earned their respect and earned their their trust that I could do it.
When you were at Motherwell, you were a professional footballer. You were kind of would have looked at, I don't know, people in the park, whatever, that, no, I'm a professional footballer. But what was the difference at Dortmund?
Oh, it was huge, James. Absolutely huge, going from Motherwell to Borussia. You could go another 10 levels higher with the training ground, with the professionalism, with the players. No disrespect to the Motherwell guys, because we had a really good team. But against that level, which you top of the tree, you're really hitting. I mean, guys had won the World Cup with Germany, who were in that Franz Beckenbauer team in 1990. And the Serie A titles that he'd won, or the Bundesliga titles that the guys had won, or Matthias Sammer, for example, was European Player of the Year. It just raised the bar. And if I never went way the bar, I think I'd have been left behind.
Also, the level of the opposition you were facing, because apart from anything else, you're now in the Champions League as well. So you had Atletico Madrid in your group.
Yeah. Steaua Bucharest and Vitesse Lodz was the four teams. And then we jumped into the quarterfinals against Auxerre, then Man United, and then Juve. So I think all in all, it was 11 games to win at that point.
Man United, was that the first time you'd played at Old Trafford?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, were you nervous at all? Was there much trepidation about that?
None whatsoever. We beat them 1-0 in Dortmund with half our team because a lot of the guys were injured. We won 1-0. After the game, the lads said, if we score at Old Trafford, it's finished. Game's over. They won't score three against us. Yeah, they had chances, but I always think when you snatch at things, it's not meant to be for you. And Jurgen Klopp had a great goal line clearance from Cantona. As soon as Lars Ricken scored the goal, I was 90% sure Manchester United would never score three against us. Never. Doesn't matter who they were or how good they were. They wouldn't score three against that team. And that game, you're talking about from me being a kind of shy kid getting into that dressing room at the beginning. By that time, I was one of them, engrossed in their mentality or their way of life, their standards and how Borussia Dortmund were.
So this would have been April 97. Was this the first trip back to Britain that you'd had since coming out, or had you been back in the meantime?
I might have been back for the national team, maybe.
Right.
Two games like that. So I might have been back for that, because I had a national game just after the Man United game, so I stayed and travelled up to Glasgow after the game. But our team was too strong in that era.
Well, the other semi-final, meanwhile, saw Juventus, who were the holders, doing a real number on Ajax, the team they'd beaten in the previous year's final. You mentioned the fact that Borussia Dortmund had a bunch of players who had either played for Juve or played in Serie A. I think there were five or six with experience of Italian football. What was the talk before the game, you know, in the build-up?
Before the final, I think Otmar never changed much. We flew to Munich on the Tuesday. We trained in Munich on the Tuesday night. The only thing Otmar really was a little bit different was he pulled me before, just after training, or just during training, it was. He says, Paul, tomorrow night, if you get the ball, look for the diagonal pass. Because in Otmar's view, Perini wasn't strong at the back post, and he always felt Peruzzi would be a puncher, the goalkeeper. He said, so if you do get, look for the diagonal, because it's we think Juventus are weak in that side. And when that happened, I thought, bang, I can do it. The only difference with the pass was I had to hit the pass with my laces rather than put a bend on it, because the bend would have took it away from Karl-Heinz Riedler. The pass itself was a straight pass.
The pass that you actually made, right.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, about Peruzzi, because he had a huge reputation in Italy. I thought of him as a tremendous shot stopper. But, yeah, I guess by the modern definition, he didn't command his area. He didn't come out until, fatefully, he did come out, and then he got done right by the end. But before we get on to the actual game then, okay, so you've already been given this heads up by the general. The story is that he also told you that you're going to be marking Zinedine Zidane. How true is that? Was that a specific job that he gave you?
My job in the Dortmund team was always, at that time, German football always had a number 10. Thomas Hassler, Mehmet Scholl. When I played in Europe, I played against Georgi Hagi, Effenberg, really top players that played number 10, Balakov at Stuttgart, some really, really top players who were excellent. Pantic at Atletico Madrid was unbelievable. The little guy from Atletico was incredible. So I knew that role. When the game lined up, Zidane was on the other side. Paolo and I looked at each other and said, we need to change. So Paolo and I flipped it as well. But Otmar always used to say to me, be wary of their special number 10. And that was him, obviously Zidane. No difference. I never realised about Zidane, how tall he was. And he had a brilliant elegance that he could go both ways. He had that great sway, lovely on the eye. But the biggest thing for me when I studied his video or his clips was if the ball was on the left side, he could drift off your shoulder. So if I caught ball washing, I knew Juve were good enough to find him. So I thought myself, I need to stay with this guy or else he's going to hurt us. And that's how it kind of materialised. And it let Andy and Paolo be the more creative ones on that. But that role was never new to me because I'd done it all season in the Bundesliga, or I'd done it against Panic or Georgi Hagi, people like that, Thomas Hasler. I played against that, so I was used to that role.
Who was the toughest person out of all of those, or anybody that you ever had to do a job like that on?
The one that gave me the biggest going over that I couldn't get near was Pantic at Atletico Madrid.
Right.
He played one touch virtually the whole game in Dortmund, and I couldn't get near the guy. I just couldn't get near him. I thought, yeah, you've had a going over there. See, Dan was different. Georgi Hagi was the best player from a standing start that I'd ever played against. He had a brilliant speed. He used to stand you up, square you up, and he had a great boof speed, but he was away. And I thought, Jesus. And he'd done it to me over in Galatasaray. Mm. And he was going through and he was about to pull the trigger. And I thought, I'm going to take him out. So I took him out, yellow card. They've got a free kick with a couple of minutes to go. We're running 1-0. And Hagi hits the crossbar and the junction of the crossbar and the post. But if I'd never done it, I think he had a good chance of hitting the target. We shot. But he was the fastest player that I played against.
Right. Zidane would be what? The most elegant? The tallest?
The most elegant, most probably dangerous, because he could go both ways. And he had a great sway. And his game intelligence was brilliant. But I knew do you know that way? Because I'd played in Germany for that period of time, I knew how they played or how they operated, the number 10s or how they actually played. They take you into places maybe you don't want to go, but I always knew the role that was a role. And I had great defenders behind me, Kola, Sama, Martin Cree, Julio Cesar. I had great defenders behind me, so they would kind of keep me right. I knew that kind of role.
The 1997 UEFA Champions League final was staged in Munich, and whilst Borussia Dortmund would be at home in Germany in their first ever final, Italian giants Juventus were the reigning champions and favourites to retain the trophy. The Bianconeri had blazed a trail throughout the campaign and were Italian champions once again.
They had an incredible squad as well, Juve. And did you know much about Zidane before the game? This was his first season, I think, at Juve.
Because he signed from, was it Bordeaux?
Bordeaux, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew a little bit about him then, this guy coming through. I knew a little bit then. But see what you said about the Juve team that year?
Yeah.
They were incredible. And Lippi, and that was a trainer. And Paolo had left the year before.
He'd been player of the year that season.
He did, and he was a brilliant player to play with, Paolo Sousa. He was a great player to play with. Oh, the injury problems obviously caught him there. But we knew the background of them. He would kind of say what De Livio was like, or Alan Bosic, or Christian Vieri, and all those guys, Montero at the back, who were proper defenders. So you kind of knew what you were coming up against.
Yeah, Montero, yes. Mm. Were you, with the knowledge that Paolo Sousa brought, with the fact that you'd seen Juve, you knew about Zidane, you thought probably he was going to be your responsibility given the way that Dortmund team set up.
Mm-hmm.
How were you feeling in the days before the game, even the night or the morning of the big game?
I was totally fine until...
Why? 9 months before, you'd been pretty much out of work considering a future as a roofer, and now here you are in the biggest club game of all.
I think the reason why is because a couple of things. I'm from Glasgow and we're fighters from there, and we don't get anything easy and you have to fight. So I had that in my makeup. I had a great drive to succeed and a great will to win. It didn't matter to me about finances or how fancy a car you had or how flamboyant you were. My main thing was to win trophies. That was my drive, was to win trophies. No, the money side of it or the aspect of that was never an interest. It was what I could look back in my career and say, do you know what, I've won this or I've won that, I've won that, which is only for my own memory, not for anybody else's, but for my own. So I had a great will to win and a great feeling of, I've been playing with these guys now for over a year. I feel really comfortable in their company or they've took to me, the fans have took to me. Everything was really good, but I was totally fine. And we went on the bus to go to the game. And we used to have an older man at the training ground, Manny Buxmeyer, his name was, who used to make his coffee in the morning or sort of our post or mail and things like that. And he was standing outside the bus and he was smoking. And he said, "Paul, how are you feeling?" I went, "Nah, I'm good, man. I'm ready." I went, "How are you?" He went, nervous, Paul, nervous. See, as soon as he said that, I went, my stomach just went, it dropped. I went, "My God, this is, and I went on the team bus that night, and you could hear a pin drop. It was deadly quiet. So I went and sat beside my normal seat beside Stephanie, and his knee was tapping. You know, his knee was bobbling up and down. And I said, "Are you okay?" He went, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "But look at everybody else. Everybody's quiet." I went, "I know." But they were so focused on what they had today, the Germans. He went, "How are you?" I went, "Stefan, I was all right. I was fine until Manny." Manny said he was nervous and that my stomach's gone. And I thought, bloody hell, this is big time. And it was brilliant. What an occasion.
There is their yellow wall on tour. Some of the most vociferous fans in the European game. With their club fulfilling their every dream.
Do you remember kind of every second of the game, or were you so focused on the job you were doing that it kind of remains a blur?
Do you know, I've never watched the game back. I've never ever seen it back. I've seen the highlights with some goals and things like that, and Zorky lifting the trophy, but I've never actually watched the game totally in its 90 minutes. The thing I do remember is in the Olympic Stadium, the bus drove into the corner areas of the Olympic Stadium. And for anybody that never knew the Olympic Stadium, and the running track. So when we played Bayern, it was full, it was a fantastic atmosphere. So I expected something similar. But when I went there, we were there maybe an hour and a bit before the game. And all I remember was from the halfway line right round to the main stand was yellow-black. And then from the other side was black and white. And the Champions League music was playing and the opera was on the field and were singing. And I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. This is going to be great. And then when you get into the dressing room, Otmar does the same rigmarole, doesn't say much. Calm. Everybody knew what we had to do. We knew the job. We were ready for it. And it was just that moment of, yeah, we're ready and hopefully we can get it.
Well, the game gets underway.
Zidane spoons up off the boot of Paul Lambert and behind for a corner. Zidane teasing Lambert and getting beyond him and effecting a shot of sorts. Those are the twinkle toes of this prodigiously talented Frenchman.
Is there a moment when you are marking Zidane or any of those players where you think, OK, I need to get into his head before he gets into mine? One of the, I don't know, a first challenge or something like that. Is there any kind of nervousness about who's going to come out on top from the early touches?
No. Do you know one thing that riled me? Yeah, probably made me kind of more, yeah, I want to win this one, because you might know this from your Italian coverage. Di Livio had a big ink mark on his wrist.
It was like, 3-1.
That was it. That's his app. And Paolo, I said to Paolo, "Have you seen that?" He went, "Yeah." He said, "He does it every time before a big game." And I thought, all right, okay, let's see how this pans out.
Yeah, well, he was right.
I know, yeah.
He was right. So, okay, so you were marking Zinedine Zidane and one of you ended up man of the match. And you'd also been told that if you did get the ball in a certain area of the pitch, you should maybe think about hitting the diagonal in. So it's about half an hour in, and it's a Dortmund corner.
Once more, Müller over a dead ball.
And the ball drops to you, and what are you thinking?
Well, with depth, Peruzzi got something on it.
Well, where I was on the pitch that night, before Andy hits the corner, I'm probably, I think, 25, 30 yards out from our box.
Right.
Because I always had to watch if Juve made a counter-attack, where Zidane would be, or German football was great for, see if somebody made a counter-attack on you, bring them down, take them out, professional game, take them out. And I always think, okay, I need to take a yellow if they do a break. But when the corner came over, they went to the head and then Peruzzi punches it. I had enough time.
Oh, okay. So he punches it out to you.
Yeah, it punches. I think he tries to punch it, then a header gets on it. And then, but I have enough time to make the run.
Came out to Lambert, who's lifted it in here for Karl-Heinz Riedler! It's Dortmund who struck first in Germany!
Well, the corner of my eye, I knew Karl Riedler and Jürgen Kohler were at the back post.
The defending champions are behind to Karl-Heinz Riedler! A moment of huge uplift for Otmar Hitzfeld.
Because you're not even looking. That's the weird thing, you know, watching it back now.
Do you know, it's funny you asking me that. Somebody asked me that the other day from Dortmund.
Müller's corner only partially cleared. Lambert's return ball was ideal. Riedler's chested touch was perfect. What a sumptuous cross from the Scotsman.
How did I know at the back post? Because before the corner even comes in, I've actually know where everybody is on the field.
Right.
I know who's where and what everybody's doing. So when the corner came in and the punch happened, the only thing I had to do was angle my body in a certain way that I could hit it with my laces rather than put a bend on it. Because if I put the bend on it, I don't think it would have had the trajectory to hit Carl Hinge either.
Right, it had gone too close to Peruzzi.
I think so. Or they'd have got their head on it. And that's when I thought, if I can get my foot round this and hit it straight, flat diagonal, it's got a chance. Because I knew Jürgen and Carla were at the back post in a 2v1 situation. Because I'd seen it beforehand.
Incredible. In that one goes, and you're 2-0 up by half-time.
On his corner. There's Riedler! It's two! Fast becoming his night! What a header that was! And Sandor Poel has seen enough for now. What a beautiful night in Germany. This has the makings of a beautiful night for Germany, and in particular for Karl-Heinz Riedler, who scored two goals inside 5 minutes either side of the half hour.
What was the dressing room like at half-time?
Calm. No stress, no 45 minutes. The Germans always used to say, 45 minutes and it's finished. If we can keep a clean sheet, then we've got it, you know. And that was what a lot of German football was built on, was make sure we don't concede. If you think it's a counter-attack, take them out.
Juventus had to react, and they have reacted. Sergio Parini has been withdrawn, and on in his place, Alessandro Del Piero. Zidane, Alan Boksic, goal side. Boksic, Del Piero is brilliant! That is brilliant! And Juventus are right back in it with the most impudent and characteristic of finishes.
Fabulous goal. Like Zola's, I guess, in the FA Cup, you could compare it to that kind of backheel flick, which made it 2-1. Were there any nerves then, or were you so professional by this point?
Their front two that night was Alan Boksic and Christian Vieri.
Yeah.
Dan in behind or floating around, and so the front two were incredibly strong. And you look at Del Piero being on the bench, and I think anybody else in that pitch, other than Zidane, could only have done that. That little flick, because it was his left foot as well. You know, it wasn't his strongest foot. I mean, but Jürgen couldn't bring Alan Boksic down, because Alan Boksic runs across Jürgen Kohler. If Jürgen clips him, I think it's a penalty.
Right.
When Del Piero makes the flick, you think to yourself, oh no. The momentum swings to them because a crowd are up for it, and then but the mentality of the Germans is, okay, we don't panic, we're still 2-1 up, we're still in the driving seat of it. But you knew Juve were going to come because of the players that they had. But that, you've got to hand it to Del Piero. The actual flick was world class.
It was genius. But then so was the move to bring on Lars Ricken. With the instructions, I think, that Peruzzi was off his line. That was something that had been discussed, no? That Peruzzi kept coming off his line, which had been the issue with the opening goal. But the contrary, that he didn't come off his line. And now he did.
Moller. Oh, Ricken's in here. It's Lars Ricken! Oh, that's extraordinary! Dreams do come true! It has not taken 20 seconds for this 20-year-old to come off the bench and score the goal! The spectacular goal that may have won the European Cup! It is the ultimate substitution on the ultimate stage!
And what are you thinking at this point?
See, if you look at the pass from Andy, the pass has split them open massively. And I don't know if anybody knows, that was Lars's first touch of the ball. That was his first touch of the ball. And Lars Ricken, if you look back at the Champions League campaign, he scored incredible vital goals for us. He scored the winner at Auxerre, he scored the winner at Man United, and he actually scored the third goal against Juve. You probably know yourself again, Peruzzi's not the tallest.
No.
He's not like a 6'4" goalkeeper. I think maybe 6'1". When Lars puts a bend on it, with the pass from Andy, I thought, Lars is in here. And then the chip, you've got to say, there's a great commentary by Marcel Reif, I think, in German. He actually commentates it as if they say, Lars, lift it over his head, and he done it. And it's one of the most iconic Champions League goals, I think.
New name on the trophy. Borussia Dortmund, first time European champions, as the old lady is slain.
So the final whistle blows. Do you go for someone's jersey?
I never, ever, ever, probably went up to somebody and asked them to change. If they wanted to change, absolutely no problem. I was never that way inclined of, I want Zinedine Zidane's jersey, or I want Rivaldo or Hadji. I got Hadji's because me and him had a right clash, which was great. Lothar Matthäus gave me his jersey because he made that incredible furlough on me. But I was never one to go up and say, hey, great game, can we change? I was always one, okay, we won the game and we do want to change, then fine. If you don't, I'm happy with my own shirt.
So you're not looking for people to swap jerseys with. What are you thinking? Are you thinking back to that trip to Amsterdam the summer before? What are you thinking about?
Do you know, I think it's brilliant being part of the Champions League group stages and semi-finals and quarter-finals, and I don't think you really realise what it is until you actually win it. When you actually lift that trophy, it gives you a great, you think, wow, this is incredible. I'm from Glasgow, from a small part of the world. I've done what Souness has done, Dalglish has done, Hansen has done, and great John Robertson in Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
There's no many of us in that, the great Lisbon Lions team. There's no many of us done it. Andy Robertson of late. But there's no many Scottish lads that have done it. I became the first British player, I think, to win it with a foreign team. Crazy that. But the actual euphoria of winning probably the biggest trophy that everybody wants. There was a great article in the programme, because at that time you still had the Cup Winners' Cup. And there was a great article. The Champions League trophy costs the least amount of money to actually make, but teams spend the most amount of money trying to win it. And I thought, my God, that is true. That is so true. The teams spend millions and millions and you still can't get it. But everybody wants that Champions League trophy. Whether you say you've won it as a footballer or you've won it as a coach or the club's actually won it, it's just that moment of, do you know what, you've done all right coming from where you've came from. That was the thing in my head.
It doesn't get any better than this. On the patch of their greatest domestic rivals, Borussia Dortmund have beaten one of the great names in European football.
So few have done what you did, and I guess even fewer can say they were man of the match in the final as well.
Do you know, I left that to other people to say whether I was good, bad or indifferent. I was always like, this is my job here. I guess it probably took me maybe 3, 4, 5 games to establish myself in the team, but Omar never left me out. And I thought, well, I'm not here by default. I'm not here by luck. These guys know that I can maybe do a job for them. And that was my job. My job was, break it up and be defensively quite strong and help that side of it, help Andy and people like that on that side of it. And I thought, well, that's my job. But I wasn't there by fluke or luck. I had an incredible journey to get there, first and foremost.
No, absolutely. But so many things could have gone a different way along that journey and in that final. But at the end of it, you're there. You were officially named man of the match, though. Did you get anything for that? Did they give you a little...
See all that sort of things. And this is probably saying that I couldn't give two hoots about all that stuff.
Really?
Nah,
You wouldn't allow yourself a slight swell of pride that... Good Lord.
No. The only thing I was... Like I said, I touched on it earlier with you. The only thing I was interested in was what I'd won.
Right.
And I can look back and know the greatest medal I've got is my brain, because I can still remember what I've won.
Right.
Not for anybody else's prestige, or just mine.
All right. Also, Callie Riedel's watch, which he gave you.
Yeah. And you know
why did he give you his watch?
This is so true. This is what I'm going to tell you. We beat Auxerre 1-0 away. And Calla's sitting in front of me on the plane coming back. I'm sitting there just sitting away and thinking, right, that's us into the semi-final. We knew we had Man United because they'd just beaten Porto. I said, Calla, I said, I've got a question for you. He said, what is it? I said, we're going to become the champions of Germany or we're going to win the Champions League. He said, you think so? I went, yeah. I said, 100%. I'm willing to actually bet you something on it. And he went, what is that? I said, if we win one of these big titles, I'll buy your watch off you. And he went, no. I said, I can't do that. He said, that's one of these kind of good ones. And I went, no. I said, I'll buy it from you. He said, No, he said, he turned around and said, if we win, he said, I'll give you. And I went, all right. And I said, what do you want from me? And I said, bear in mind, I'm from Glasgow. We don't give anything away for free. He says, no. He said, let's see what happens. And after the game, he threw it to me. And he went, there you go. That's for winning. But on the Friday, we still one game left to play against Cologne. On the Friday, we came in and he says, come here, I might show you something. I said, what is it? He had a spanking brand new one on. His actual watch. I went, that's how you get. He said, no, that watch there is a good watch. He said, and that's exactly what happened.
Do you still have that?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? I came back to Glasgow and a guy offered me so much money for it. And I said, no, because he said, I know the story behind it because the Glasgow media did on it. I went, for sentimental value, it'll never leave us.
Okay, that's one trophy that does matter. Do you think that Dortmund side are unfairly overlooked when people talk about the great sides of the 90s?
100%. That team would rival anything at that period of time. If that team was at its strongest, that was proper. You're talking about proper men. I mean, Jurgen Kohler, again, you've probably seen him at Juve, was the best man marker. The ball went by Jurgen, the man never, and vice versa. I've never played with or seen a centre-half like that. Matthias Sammer was a libero, was European Player of the Year. He was like an extra midfield player, the way he played. And Julio Cesar, if Julio ever broke sweat, I'd love to have seen it, because he never, ever broke sweat. And do you know what? The funny story about Julio, you talk about funny things that happen. My second game against Dusseldorf, my legs were agony. The grass burns at the side of my legs, and it Dortmund had a lovely big bath, and the steam was rising off it. And you know when you go in your bath, your legs are sore, they start to nip. And I goes into the bath, and I went, I can smell smoke here. What's going on here? I smell smoke. And just like that, the steam dispersed from the bath. And Julio's at the back of the bath with cigarette, just smoking away. Paul, well done. This guy's no broke sweat. And when you look at it, Sosa, Serie A player of the year, Michael Zorc is the club captain, and Riedler, Sharpie, Andy Muller, Stefan Reuter, Jörg Heine, all internationals. And that team, somebody asked me, what's the difference between the Celtic team you played with, the UEFA Cup team, the Borussia Dortmund team? And the only great compliment I can give the two of them is, one was a special team, one was a great team. And the Dortmund team was special because it was part of an era where could that team hold their own anywhere, 100%. And getting into the Juve game, did I ever view as no being favourites? I never. I always thought we'd win it because I knew the players that were behind me. People on the outside probably thought Juve, Zidane, De Levy, all these guys. But my own heart, my own head, I always thought we could win it.
You left pretty quickly after that. What was it, November the following season?
Yeah.
For family reasons.
Yeah.
What was saying goodbye like?
Well, horrendous. Absolutely. I could have went anywhere in Europe after that game. I had so many calls. They want to go and play in Italy.
Kazakhstan, even?
That thankfully, it left me. I could have went anywhere in Europe because of obviously what had happened. And I got calls all over the place. And I said, no, I'm really happy here. I don't need to move. I'm with the European champions. I'm with a great team. I'm with fans that love me. I don't want to move for money. I'm really happy here. And that was the end of it. In the summertime, that was the end. And then my son wasn't well. He had a thing or an illness called febrile convulsions, which meant a baby would go unconscious every so often when it happened. And it wasn't a nice thing to see at that time. So we thought, then Wim Janssen, God rest him, I was playing Belarus up in Aberdeen, and I was cleaning my boots before the game. So maybe an hour and 20 minutes before the game in Belarus in a World Cup qualifier. And Hampden was getting renovated at that point. So we played it in Aberdeen. I was cleaning my boots and I heard the door closing, and Wim Janssen and Murdo McLeod were standing in the boot room and says, I want to sign you for Celtic. And I says, no, I've got a game here. I can't talk about this. He said, no, can you give me one chance to try and sign you? I went, no, I'm fine. I don't need you to come back. He said, please don't take that in any bad way. I said, I'm really happy in Dortmund. And then things kind of went really quickly. And then Dortmund had a chat. They'd done everything, to be fair, to make me stay in. They offered me more money. It was nothing to do with money. It was nothing whatsoever to do with money. The press guy said, Paul, if you're leaving, I think we have to tell the fans, because you're playing Parma. I was playing Parma on the Wednesday. And he said, I think it's better you tell them you're going to go, because I think there's going to be so much emotion in the stadium. Well, Neville Scala was the trainer, James. Mm-hmm. And Neville said...
Former Parma manager as well.
Yeah. And Parma at that time, Buffon, Thuram.
Zola was there, no?
I think Zola was there.
Yeah.
Cannavaro, Benarivo.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible team. And they always said, we'd love you to stay. He said, please don't go. And I said, no, I have to go. It's tough in the minute. He said, I know you're going to tell the fans you're leaving. And I thought, I think the crowd are going to criticise me here. And I thought, this is going to be a tough game. This is emotionally and the actual game itself. So we played the game. There must have been we got a penalty. And the yellow wall started singing Paul Lambert as if he hit it, hit the penalty. And I thought, no, we have to win the game. Andy has to hit the penalty. And Andy scores two that night, I think. And about 10 minutes before the game, I could hear my name getting sung, Paul Lambert. And I said, oh, here it comes. They're going to criticise me here. And it never stopped. The final whistle went. And next thing I seen all these banners going up. Please don't go, Paul. Thanks very much. And I thought, wow. So I'd done a little lap of honour and I stood in front of the yellow wall and nobody left. You know, I thought, these people aren't leaving. They're leaving. They started to sing Walk On. And I thought, well, at that time, I said to myself, what am I doing? This is wrong, what I'm doing. I can't leave. I can't leave. This is too difficult. So I goes back inside and the press guy says, Paul, you need to go back out. They're not leaving. So he gave me a coat. I went back out and the players all stood and clapped. Neville stood and clapped. And I stood in front of the yellow wall and I thought, I'm choking up here. I need to say goodbye finally. And this is the end. And then some people were crying. I could see a lot of people crying in the stand. I thought, I need to go. Because I had to sign forms at midnight.
Midnight that night?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the release forms, yeah. And then I was up in Mr. Meyer's office. Yeah, just about 11:30 time or 11:45. I said, Paul, don't go. And I was like, I know, you're right. You're right what you're saying. I know what I'm doing is crazy, but I have to go back to my son. He needs his own backyard. And we came back. I went to get my car that night and there was hundreds of people around my car and they draped banners over my car, don't go and sorry you're leaving and things like that. And it was terrible. And for Celtic, for 2 months, I was terrible.
Yeah, it must have been a tough readjustment, especially coming in a couple of months into the season. You go back quite a lot, though, to Dortmund. You were saying you've been back there quite recently. I did read you saying that one thing you'd like to do, one unfulfilled ambition, would actually be standing there in the Sud Tribune, in the yellow wall. Have you done that yet, Paul? Or when are you going to do it?
I've done it.
You've done it?
I've done it.
How was it?
It was... So it was a few years ago, and Jürgen was the coach, well before the pandemic. Me and the missus went over. So I phoned the club, and I said to the club, I said, can I get two tickets for the game? Absolutely, Paul, no problem. VIP room and VIP, no problem. I went, no, I don't want to go there. I want to go in the yellow wall. And they went, no, you're crazy. I said, no, I'm going in. I need to go in. So I put a hat and my glasses and that on, and they gave us VIP tickets for the hospitality, but the tickets for the game was in the yellow wall.
Mm.
I says, I think we should go in pretty early because this is going to be an incredible experience. So we found a spot bang right in the middle of it, right? And I said, do you need the toilet? She says, no. I said, well, see when this starts to fill up, we ain't moving. So if you're going to need the toilet, you're going to have to do it virtually down your leg because we are not going to get you. We can't move here. This is going to be incredible. So anyway, the game, the crowd start to come in. And about maybe an hour before the game, it starts to erupt. The players aren't even out in the warm-up. It's starting to bounce. And you think, geez, this thing's moving. This stand's moving. It's swaying. She went, this is moving. I went, I know. This is ridiculous. Anyway, the game starts. Dortmund, I think they draw 2-2 with Cologne. And Marco Reus scores two. Now, honestly, James, I was soaked in beer. The smell of things that were in there was incredible. And I thought to myself, that is an unbelievable end to go into. And I tell you what, I always said, if I played in front of it, I always wanted to go into it and watch it. I would recommend anybody to go in there and watch a game of football because it was fantastic.
Did they never discover your true identity?
No, because I had my glasses and the hat and everything.
Right, okay.
I even bought a Dortmund scarf and I had it up to my neck, and I was because I've got in Dortmund they've got a thing called the Walk of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
My star is over there, so there's only 100 kind of round about the vicinity of the city and the stadium. And
right,
then I got a phone call saying, Paul, would like you to come over and see your star in the Walker. I couldn't go that time because I was manager somewhere. But since then, I've seen it and I've looked at it, which is really nice.
I mean, it's not bad, is it? From when you stood there with Billy Davis in, what, 94, going, imagine playing here, to winning the title, winning the Champions League there. Extraordinary. What a journey. You've had other great highs, a title-winning side at Celtic, all the things you won there, Old Firm games, Scotland at the World Cup. You were part of the 98 team. But if you could go back and play once more with any of the teams that you've had in your career, which would it be? Would it be that Dortmund side, that brief time with Dortmund?
Oh, that's a really difficult question. Do you know the Old Firm game that you just mentioned there?
Right.
It's probably one of the most iconic games I think any footballer could play in. And I'm talking about, you could probably go to Palo de Canio or Paul McStay, or you could go to Gaza or Brian Loudon and say to them, what's that Old Firm like? It is iconic and unique. I always say you could play the Old Firm in the moon and people would travel to watch it.
Right.
It's the one game in the world that everybody wants to see. It is frantic, it's hectic, it is unbelievable atmosphere. Dortmund Schalke is mental as well. That's crazy as well. The two teams, as I said, one was special, one was great. If I could relive probably two games again, I think I would probably go when we beat Rangers 2-0 at Parkhead and I scored a goal that goes into the top corner in probably a Champions League final. If I could play two games again and relive them, would be they two.
Yeah, those are two pretty solid choices.
James, can I just say something as well?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary of the Bosman, John Mark Bosman. You ever
right.
seen? So I watched that, right? And I knew I was maybe number two at that time. So Bosman really came about.
It was that early that you... Because, yeah, it was December, I think, 96.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I took advantage...
Sorry, no, just to say, but a lot of people won't know this about the about the way that changed. I was even surprised that you would know about it, or that I'm curious about how much footballers knew about what it meant potentially for them, that, you know, within months of it happening.
Well, you're right. And Rob McKinnon, who was my teammate, who did take advantage of it to go to 20 Enschede, I was the second. And then I think John Collins might have been the third to go into Monaco. So I watched this documentary when I was Ipswich manager. So I watched it. And do you know what? It was heartbreaking. I thought, I want to make contact with that guy. So I actually did. And through Zoom, I actually spoke to him through Zoom. He'd an interpreter, because obviously the English, he didn't know English.
Mm.
And I actually said to him, do you know, I watched your documentary. It was incredible how you've done it and sacrificed yourself for people like me and people everywhere else in the world. You sacrificed yourself. I said, I just want to say, without you, my life wouldn't have been the same as what it is today. So I thanked him for it, because what he went through with alcoholism and losing everything, his family and everything, to go through that, to help people like myself and other guys, as I say, I wanted to thank him personally for what he'd done, because you're right, all the years ago, people wouldn't have known about the Bosman thing, where I knew exactly what was happening.
Yeah, and people now probably don't realise that before that, you belonged to a club until they decided to let you go, even if your contract had run out.
Yeah, 100%.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it was incredible. And you're right, the story for me going from what it was to what I became to what it gave me, it was a stuff of fairy tale that was. Would it happen now? No, that would never happen now.
Why?
Because I think players have got everything there now. I think they've got everything there. They've got the agents to do everything. Would anybody take a gamble and go and play 4 trial games? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that would happen.
Players wouldn't travel to Amsterdam without even knowing who...
Who you're meeting
trials with?
No, or who you're going to meet? I never saw Ton van Dalen before, so I never knew what the guy was going to look like until he came up and says, "Paul, pleased to meet you."
Incredible. All right. Well, congratulations, Paul. I'm sure you would have made an amazing roofer, but this
I think that and you talk about hard trade. I wouldn't have liked to have done it, but there was nothing else there. Do you know what's funny as well? I went to Real Madrid.
Uh huh.
When Carlo was the coach, the first time. And when I left Aston Villa and I went to Real Madrid for 5 days, I got introduced to him, Zinedine Zidane. It was actually Paul Clement that says, this is Paul Lambert, he played against you in Borussia Dortmund. And he went, bloody hell. He realised, see, that game was the one game that he thought they'd have had us. But he thought, he looked at this, put his hand in his head as if to say, ah, how they lost that night. That was, because they were the favourites there, but to beat that German team, so you had to be some team to beat us.
Pods.